Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, listeners, and welcome to Horror Hill. I'm your host and narrator, Eric Peabody, and tonight's episode features two stories from author Jesse Pullins. As you may recall, Jesse wrote The Swan, which we covered several weeks back. I enjoyed that one quite a bit, and we here at Horror Hill decided to put the screws to Jesse so we could get a few more stories. To start, we have Prisoner Transport, in which a seemingly wimpy and over-restrained inmate reveals that he has quite the trick up his sleeve. After that, we'll close with Rainbow Road, where a group of friends swapping stories results in one particularly harrowing trip down memory lane. Also, I'd like to mention that both of these stories and a bunch of Jesse's other work are available over at Velux Books. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Jesse Pullins, I give you Prisoner Transport. He had an air of blatant arrogance about him. Even as the transport van bucked us with every pothole in the back road, his eyes never left mine. As he stared at me, his face would transition from emotionless to amused, sometimes offering a smile or furrowing his brow like he was some kind of AI trying to troubleshoot a human reaction. I looked away often, not wanting to feed him the attention he seemed starved for. My eyes wandered to the floor, at the shackles around his ankles, a jingling chain swaying between his legs that seemed almost overkill for the scrawny individual it was fastened to. I found myself trailing up from the shackles, over the red jumpsuit, to the straitjacket that had been used in place of handcuffs. A thick leather strap was fastened tightly across his chest, holding him firmly in place as the van bounced down the road. The man before me looked so small and helpless, like a little kid that had been cast to play a prisoner in a movie. Stuart Kavanaugh was a high-profile prisoner transport on his way to death. Seeing him in person was almost disappointing, his lack of muscle or tattoos making him look like a pitiful vanilla suburban house husband. He was supposed to be some kind of mass murderer, a 2020 Charles Manson wannabe that had a few dozen deaths under his belt, some kind of master manipulator, leaving a harrowing trail behind him wherever he seemed to shuffle. People would die, gruesomely, but never by his hand. One way or another, he would always get someone to do his bidding. No one could figure out how he did it. It had become enough of a problem that the state, out of desperation, was ferrying him to the closest prison that still practiced the death penalty. Death by lethal injection, or whatever means necessary, effective as soon as possible. Transport Stuart William Kavanaugh immediately, only the highest of clearances. Extremely low profile. No news, no announcement. This had been my first taboo transport of sorts, one that wasn't funded by the rich family of a known kidnapping or a political power move from behind the curtain. They wanted this guy gone. Bad. Our route consisted mostly of erratic backroads with a cut through the town of Dyer Falls, all in an attempt to dodge the press and whatever theoretical peons Kavanaugh had working under him. As he stared at me, it boggled me what was so dangerous about a shrimp like him. Thin, geeky glasses, arms like toothpicks, and beady little eyes. I could probably beat this man to death in 4 seconds. I was twice his size, and I could bench press 3 times his body weight. He knew it, too. And still, he stared at me like some kind of fucking animal. Another pothole shook our cabin, one that stifled a muffled groan from my colleague next to me. He readjusted on the bench and returned to browsing his phone, the popping of his gum almost inaudible under the suppression of the earplugs. The only things of interest in the bare transport van were a first aid kit and a fire extinguisher. The earplugs were the only known foolproof defense against Kavanaugh's bullshit. It was a rule that we had to follow during the transport, one I kept hearing on repeat from the tired voice of the commissioner. Do not, under any circumstances, remove your earplugs. I thought of the plugs lodged uncomfortably in my ears and couldn't help but look at Kavanaugh's face. He raised one eyebrow, much like Tim Curry in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. This taunt was met with silence, as I had done many times before, with many people much bigger than him. His jest made me think of the gun holstered at my side and the weight of it hanging, an incredibly expensive but equally deadly sidearm loaded to the brim with 50 caliber Action Express hollow points, but that special kind that would bloom into a star shape during the trajectory. It was grossly overpowered and by all means unnecessary, but when you contract private security firms to cab ride your problem child, they privately outfit. Next to me, my colleague, known only as Weber, was busy burying his nose in his phone. A major infraction by the company's standards, but this was the norm for him, even though he looked like a teenager out of his element. This was my third ride with Weber, and during the second of which, I had witnessed him killing the transport in self-defense, brutally. Kavanaugh watched Weber, and when he saw him looking back, he simply winked at him and went back to perusing his phone. Tinder, from the looks of it. Kavanaugh scowled at Weber, but whatever noise he made, I couldn't hear. After failing to get a rise out of him, he turned back to me and settled in like he was watching a movie. It was annoying, sure, but this was nothing. We once had a guy who bit off his own tongue and would collect the blood in his mouth until he had enough to jet stream our visors like that dinosaur from Jurassic Park. The worst part was, we had no idea when he actually did bite his tongue off. He did it silently, without emotion. For a while, we all wobbled in silence. The ride was only supposed to be 2 hours, and this one felt like 3 already. Not a good sign, but it was how it always went. Eventually, we would jump out of this shuttle, and the money would spend the same. Kavanaugh continued to stare at me, cycling through facial expressions as we maintained eye contact. It looked very unlike him, like the actions didn't match his face. He looked like the type to grill at a Saturday get-together, flipping burgers and khaki shorts with his socks rolled up to his knees. To see him do stupid shit like cross his eyes intentionally or make silent fart noises with his tongue was just strange. Despite my lack of engagement, he still continued long after I stopped paying attention. Another pothole shook the vehicle, and Weber almost dropped his phone. He proceeded to pound on the wall of the van with a gloved fist and yell something I assumed was, "Settle down, you goofy bitch," before immediately going back to scrolling and swiping. Swiping right a lot, it would seem. I shifted in my seat, trying to relieve the numbness on one side of my ass and push it to the other. My gun dug uncomfortably into my hip, and I readjusted my cell phone so the barrel wouldn't shatter the screen. Kavanaugh watched me while I did this, pausing his annoying kissy face like he had suddenly discovered something of interest. His lips unpuckered and formed into a disturbing sort of ear-to-ear smile. I paid it no mind, but the sudden change in tactics was curious. Some prisoners kept to themselves. Others begged to be let go. Prisoners like Stuart were hell-bent on tormenting you until you slipped. Whether it was to cause an opening or just for the satisfaction of goading was beyond me. Stuart started mouthing words. It was easy to ignore him at first, just simply avoid looking at his face. If I could just keep my gaze on his shackles and straitjacket, I could track his activity until we arrived at our destination. I was fine for a few minutes, and would have stayed fine if my ego didn't get the best of me. After all, every bull wants to be challenged. I looked at his face and tried my best to make out what he was saying through his slow lip syncing. I expected something like rent-a-cop or pussy, but what I deciphered was nothing along those lines. No jab or provoking insult. Just two words said plainly over and over. Yellow ball. I became instantly anxious. My guts felt like they were melting together, and I got the sudden urge to throw open the back door and run as far away from the van as I could. I can't really put the feeling into words. It felt like, well, like death itself. Like I was being forced to watch someone get hit by a car, but the car was still a block away, gaining in the distance. He had my attention now, and he knew it. I looked at Weber, who was still glued to his phone. Kavanaugh sat and waited, smug and wrapped in his straitjacket with his eyebrows raised like he had moved a chess piece and was waiting my turn. I started to sweat, and my breathing felt uncontrolled and labored. His prying eyes made me self-conscious and painfully aware of the things near me. The tight fit of my body armor, the heavy weight of the gun in its holster, the lodged shape of the phone in my pocket. I tried to look away from Kavanaugh, but every time I broke eye contact, I could hear those two words like he was speaking inside my head. Yellow ball, yellow ball, yellow ball. His arrogance only frustrated me, and I couldn't understand how it was getting to me so suddenly. I had been on a ton of transport jobs with all shapes and sizes, and this dweeb was getting under my skin. My face and ears were getting hot. It was hard to breathe in the armor, like someone was sitting on my chest. Despite my discomfort, I reminded myself of the important rule stressed by the commissioner. Do not, under any circumstances, remove your earplugs. Kavanaugh took a deep breath and mouthed the two words again. Yellow ball. I pinched the ends of each earplug and pulled them out, letting in the sound of the bumpy road and the van's engine. Kavanaugh smiled. You say something to me, punk? I said, quieter than I expected. Weber didn't hear. It was just me and the prisoner now. Kavanaugh said nothing for a moment, and I could see his pupils shifting as they rapidly stared into each of my eyes individually. He was calm, collected. When he finally spoke, it was hushed and gentle. Do you think the bones of a child taste different than the bones of an adult? There was something icy about his words. It made me sick to my stomach. "What did you just say?" I asked, a little louder.
"They're bones. I've never tried cannibalism, but I've always wondered if it would taste differently."
"You best keep your mouth shut for the rest of the ride, or we're gonna have a fucking problem. They said nothing about the condition we had to deliver you in," I said, seething. Having given my warning, I started to return the earplugs to my ears.
"Scary,"
Kavanaugh tisked and tilted his head forward.
"But tell me, was it a spontaneous gift, or did she pick it out herself?"
he asked. "I don't know what you're talking about."
"Sure, sure. What do you think their last thoughts are as they're dying? Do they ask for mommy, or do they ask for God?"
The words raked down my back like ice. I thought of the gun and how much better I would feel if it was in my hand. "Shut your fucking mouth, or I'll knock all of your teeth out. I'm sure they'd like that where you're going. Very beneficial." As I leaned forward, the prisoner clicked his tongue.
"Cute. Just put it all on the table. Big, strong man like yourself. How many of you preached that same threat? Is that what does it for you?"
he hissed.
"Funny story. I once asked a man to pull out his own teeth, one by one. He cried and sobbed, and there was so much blood. But he still did it. Best part is, he still had enough strength to strangle the DoorDash driver when she dropped off the food I was going to eat in front of him."
"Sure, sure," I said, looking at Weber. He was still distracted, slightly turned and hunched over his phone. I went to nudge him when the prisoner spoke again, and even though I didn't want to, I listened.
"Is it weird that I feel more pity for a fish? A dog will follow you loyally to its own demise, but fish, no. You can see it in their eyes, swimming around as you pour them into the blender, like they know their owners would betray them in the long run."
I looked away. The earplugs were rolling away on the vibrating floor. One of them stopped against Weber's boot. He didn't notice, and the prisoner was still talking.
"It would be so easy. Probably kicking it around right now. Right in the front yard, right under mommy's nose. You think you could get there in time?"
"I don't know.
Really? Scoop her right up, like she was never there. You think she'd know the difference between cereal and thumbtacks? Do you think she'd care?"
My blood was boiling. My hand squeezed, suddenly feeling heavy. "I'd kill you," was all I could say.
"Would you? Or would you join for breakfast?"
"You're fucking sick, you know that?"
"Yeah, I'm sick, all right. Sick of being in these restraints. I think I've hung around here long enough. It was interesting to see the government dogs scramble in their attempt to control me, the whole time thinking they had me. It's hilarious, isn't it? They're so sure of themselves. Just a bunch of people looking to collect a check. Like you. Not professional in the least. You couldn't even keep the plugs in."
I stared at him, grinding my teeth together so hard it hurt. He smirked at me briefly before turning to Weber. He had finally looked up from his phone. "Did you remove your hearing protection?" he asked, immediately alarmed. His look of confusion was reduced to a malformed rupture of gore as his visor shattered in a spray of red. The gunshot was deafening, ringing off the inside of the van. The gun in my hand was smoking, the large, ejected casing bouncing off the floor.
"Oh, God, what the fuck?"
was all I could muster before the van slammed on its brakes. I was thrown into the still bleeding corpse of Weber, struggling to stay upright as his body ragdolled into mine. The eviscerated melon that remained for a head leaked profusely under the helmet, splashing at my armor in hot bursts. My boots slipped under the spatter, and as I tried to regain my composure, Kavanaugh remained perfectly in place in his harness. Weber's smartphone screen shattered as it landed face down.
"Oh my, what have you done? Those guns just go off, don't they? He taunted.
You son of a bitch!
I spat, whipping the gun around. I shot him twice, center mass, the gun barking loudly with each squeeze of the trigger, each blast more deafening than the last. I gaped as I saw that both of my shots had missed, one shattering his shackles, the other blasting the hinge that held the strap over his chest. The gun was aiming on its own. Once the van stopped, I heard the sounds of the drivers throwing their doors open from the outside. Kavanaugh laughed and stood from his seat, shaking the restraints off awkwardly from the confines of his straitjacket.
What? How did you... How?
Was all I could say. I pointed the large gun at him, but couldn't seem to squeeze the trigger. I couldn't seem to do anything.
Here's the deal. When your buddies open that door, they're going to hold their fire. Instead of restraining me, one is going to see how many long sticks he can fit in his throat until he passes away. The other is going to be so kind as to remove this jacket right before he chooses the same makeover you once gave your friend.
Bullshit! They'll stop you!
I said, wanting to grab and restrain him, but unable to find the will. My body simply refused to respond. Kavanaugh crouched next to me and leaned forward to whisper in my ear. The shouting outside was getting louder, but I couldn't make out what they were saying. Through the ringing in my ears, all I could hear was the prisoner.
Or they won't. Tell me, your wife and child, do you think they would miss you if I took them? Do you think they would hear you if you spoke to them? Do you think they would reach out to you if you were running after them? Would they cry for help? Or would they smile and wave?
Think about that when you grab that fire extinguisher over there. I looked at the red can fastened to the wall as the voices boomed outside the door. Kavanaugh leaned in closer, his breath hot in my ear.
I'm sure you'll find the fine line between consciousness and concussion. And when you wake up, use that cell phone of yours and call for backup. Let them know what happened. Remind them of their fear for me.
With that, Kavanaugh stood and faced the door. I dropped my gun and shuffled to the extinguisher, looking sadly at Weber as I freed it from its housing. The prisoner faced the doors as the shouts reached their peak outside the vehicle, like he was about to walk onto a stage. I removed my helmet and laid it on the floor, blood soaking into my suit as I held the extinguisher above my head. I told myself I looked that way so I could watch him go, but I knew I did it to better aim for my temple. With a farewell, Kavanaugh looked at me with one last smirk before facing the doors ahead of him, just in time for them to fly open. As sunlight spilled in around his silhouette, I pulled the extinguisher down as hard as I could. It was dusk when I awoke. My vision collected through the haze of neon pink, and I tried to remember where I was. A throbbing pressed on the inside of my skull, and my ears rang. I tried to get to my feet, slipping as I steadied myself. Through the light of the setting sun, I saw the blood-soaked floor and the slumped corpse of Weber against the wall of the van. It came back slowly, the prisoner, the earplugs, the gunshot. I looked at the fire extinguisher lying on its side and the echoing words that followed. Let them know what happened. I shambled out of the van and jumped down, feeling the crunch of gravel under my boots. We were on a dirt road, heavy forest lining each side of the path. The van had skidded to a stop on the shoulder in the middle of nowhere. The dizziness faded in and out as I squinted at the sun that poked through the trees. My legs were shaking, and as I tried to get them under control, I found myself vomiting instead. Through the pounding in my head and convulsing of my guts, I saw the first corpse in the road. It was laying on its side, its face unrecognizable through the gore that splattered the inside of the visor. The top of the helmet was exploded outward, a collection of flies swarming the trail of gory matter that followed the gunshot.
The gun was still clutched in the body's hand. Opposite the gunshot victim was a second body, almost posed for display. The corpse was on its knees, head held back like they were yelling at the sky. Protruding from their mouth was a cluster of misshapen sticks, some of them larger and more jagged than the others. Each of them looked to fit impossibly in the horribly stretched mouth. Between the two bodies was a folded red prison jumpsuit and a discarded straitjacket. "Remind them of their fear for me." I felt for my phone, deciding it was time to call the police. My hands were shaking, and it took me several tries to properly hit the power button. When the screen finally lit up, I could only stare at it with sobering clarity. The lock screen was a picture of my daughter. Her joyous smile captured mid-laugh. Held tight in her arms was a bright yellow ball.
Love horror stories? Well, I've got plenty to share. I'm Otis Gyre, your host, for Otis Gyre's Nightmare Fuel, where every week I spin spine-chilling tales that'll have you sleeping with the lights on. Picture this. A crackling campfire, the dark woods of Camp Duskwood, and twilight like whispering in the distance. That's where I invite campers, just like you, to join me around the fire as I share stories of haunted highways, cursed deals, and things lurking just out of sight. If you're a fan of Eric Peabody and Horror Hill, you'll feel right at home by my fire. So pull up a seat. The stories are dark, fire's warm, and there's always room for one more camper. Just don't wander too far into the woods. You never know what's watching. Otis Jarvie's Nightmare Fuel has just debuted, and I've got spine-tingling episodes waiting for you to binge right now. New campers, join me every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for Fresh Tales of Terror. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find quality podcasts. Join the campfire, if you dare.
You've been listening to Prisoner Transport by Jesse Pullins. Next, also from Jesse Pullins, here's Rainbow Road. Everybody has that story they tell. The memory hangs out in the backseat of your mind, waiting for the right moment to chip in the group and share your childhood fear. The first time you were scared, the first time you felt real fear. By the time you tell the story, you almost forgot it had even happened. Maybe it was just a fever dream you had as a child. Maybe the circumstances were fabricated by your adolescent imagination. Even though you doubt it even happened, the memory still lingers, held more dear than what should have been your cherished moments when you were younger. When you think back, you don't remember the first time you tied your shoes or the first basketball hoop you made. You think of that story. It's there, waiting, almost as if it has unfinished business with you, like you're not allowed to move on from it yet. And you tell the story with a big smile on your face, the ones around you laughing so hard they ugly cry, because your experience was so real and relatable, it could have happened to them just as easily as it happened to you. Once you've shared it, you feel better, and the memory retreats back into its den, hibernating until the stars align and it can torment you once more. I was at work when the opportunity presented itself. The night shift was over, and we were all in the locker room, exchanging thick uniforms and heavy boots for Crocs and basketball shorts. Terry was telling a story about his fear of rats, his face a half-grin as he struggled to get through it without laughing. I was on the bench, unlacing my boots.
Dude, I had been looking for this fucking rat for weeks. I would always see it out of the corner of my eye, little bastard scurrying around when I was trying to sleep. Turns out it had made a nest in the box spring. I had been sleeping on it, dude, Terry said, shivering as he thought back. The other guys laughed, a cackling chorus of grown men amused by someone else's demise. I laughed as well. Terry was well known for his fear of rodents and was heckled about it constantly. They went back and forth over the details as I kicked off my boots. How did he deal with it? Did he burn the mattress? Did he let it sleep there forever? As the laughter died down, I thought of my story and wondered if I should tell it. At first, I shivered at the thought, but before I knew it, I was grinning and dying to let it out. The old memory resurfaced like a shark from the deep, a story that happened 23 years ago, a story about a beaver. All right, I got one. Terry, you'll especially like this, I said, standing up. The guys listened, still wiping the tears from the rat in Terry's mattress. It had been so long since I'd thought of the beaver, and the details flooded in as I pictured it in my head. All right, so this was a really long time ago when I was a kid. I think I was 5 or 6. Anyway, I used to live in this trailer park over on Rainbow Road, that one over there by the highway. I vaguely point north as I close my locker. There are a few interjections before the story continues. Wait, Rainbow Road? Yeah, I know that place. My aunt used to live there. You used to live in the cans, Jay, over by 94? Terry asked. Yeah, long time ago. Been ages, I said, and resumed the story. Anyway, it was in the summer back in the 90s, and we were all playing outside. Not shit to do. There was nothing but trailers and a long line of mailboxes. We were all poor, and there was no playground to play at, so most of the time, all the kids would just group up, and we would walk around and play with rocks and shit. We would walk around all day, and our parents didn't care as long as we didn't go by the highway. They were always worried about a car hitting us, I said, and in my mind, I could hear the sounds of cars passing by. So, there's like 5 of us playing by this trailer that didn't have anyone living in it, and all of a sudden, one of the kids just freezes and says, what's that? We all look, and sitting on the porch of the trailer is this big fucking beaver just staring at us, I said, the beaver's black eyes and teeth clear in my mind. I shuddered at the thought of it. The guys laughed, and Terry visibly cringed. So we're all frozen there, all of us too scared to move. We'd never seen one before. We're all terrified of this beaver, and it's just staring us down, and we're just waiting for it to rush us, like it was going to eat our bones or something. Real scary shit. Anyway, there's this girl standing next to me. I think her name was Kirsten. She whispers to me and says, "Go get your mom, we'll stay here." My house was the closest, only 2 trailers away. So I run home, thinking this beaver is going to chase me like it's some kind of horror movie or something. And I run and tell my mom, and she starts yelling about us playing by the highway. And the whole time, I'm just scared shitless this beaver was going to eat my friends by the time we got back. "No shit. What happened? You guys get attacked?" one of the guys says, and I laugh. No, my mom grabbed a broom and we went back and she pretty much shooed it off. But I still can't shake the look that beaver gave us. We really thought it was going to eat us. Fucking hate beavers, dude. I finished the story and they all laughed, all except Terry, who looked like he found something new to add to his list of rodent fears. I chuckled to myself at the thought of the memory, feeling a bit of the weight lift from my mind. Like a shred of the trauma was healed. After some brief shit-talking, we all punch out and leave the building, everyone walking to their cars with their heads held high now that the day's work was done. I wave goodbye and get in my car. As I watch the other guys pull away and drive off, I find myself sitting there in silence, pondering the story I told. I think of the beaver story, with its nasty buck teeth and black eyes. I think of how funny it is looking back, and I hear the laughter of the guys in my head. The longer I think about it,
the more the laughter fades away, and the more I hear screams instead. I think of the story, suddenly feeling guilty, wondering why I said it in the first place. Maybe, after all this time, I'm just trying to make myself feel better. In my head, the memory unravels. I think of the story and how it's a lie. There's no beaver. There never was. I lean my head on the steering wheel. I hadn't thought of it in so long. I was sure I could leave it in the past. I hear the screams, my own and those of the other children. I think of the unexplainable memory pushed so far in the back of my mind. Kirsten was my first crush. I remember her freckled face and short hair and a little red ball cap she would always wear. Everyone thought she looked like a boy, but I thought she was pretty, even though I really didn't know the meaning of the word. She lived across the park in a yellow trailer and would always come over to play when all the kids got together. There were five of us, and only a few of us had bikes, so if we all wanted to play together, we would usually walk around and play with sticks and stuff like that. Sometimes we'd play tag or Red Rover, but that day we found ourselves just walking around, bored. The trailer park was an oval formation, the mobile homes placed in a loop with a circular road in the middle. It was surrounded by trees, except for the side I lived on that was tucked into a hill that the highway was built on. It was nice outside that day. Our parents booted all of us out of the house so we could enjoy the weather and so they could have some peace and quiet. They only had two rules: don't talk to strangers and don't go near the highway. The park wasn't fenced off or anything, and you could hear cars and trucks flying past all day long. We were walking the road in a little group, doing laps without any real plan. We continued like this for a while, every time passing each other's houses and telling jokes, sometimes nagging our parents if we could come in yet. Two trailers down from mine was the only vacant lot in the park. Nobody lived there as far as we knew. The driveway was always empty, with a concrete slab in place of a trailer. The backyard consisted of an uphill climb through the trees that led straight to the highway. It was silly, but between the emptiness of the vacant trailer and the sounds of the highway, it felt like that specific lot was separate from the rest of the park. I don't know if it was the shade from the overgrown trees, the layers of old pine needles on the ground, or the dead sticks scattered about the unkempt yard. There was just always something about it, like it was in its own little bubble. That's when the dares started. On that particular boring day, one of the kids had the idea that for every lap we took around the park, one of us would have to step foot on the lot. The mini barren zone always gave us the willies, and the thought of pushing the boundaries of the scary property gave us all a shot of rebellious adrenaline. At first, I thought it was scary, and I was worried about getting into trouble. But when I saw Kirsten perk up giddily, I decided to play along so I could impress her. Whatever I could do to seem cool and make her smile. It felt like we were doing something bad, and the excitement of who would go the furthest would hurry us along as we walked each lap around the park. We would take turns. The first lap, one of us would walk into the driveway. The next, we would go up and touch one of the sticks, etc. I remember on one of my turns, I crept into the yard behind the little driveway and sprinted back, comically yelling like something was chasing me all the way back to the road. Looking back, it was immature, but it felt like the unexplainable gloom was always trying to nip at your heels. Hours passed as we repeated the cycle, a lap around the park, then one of us running in. There, toward the end, we were jogging around the park, all of us excited to take our next turn. As time went on, kids would get called to come home, and the group began to dwindle. We started to push faster, each of us paranoid to be the next kid to be walking away from the fun with our head hung low as the others laughed. Before we knew it, almost everyone had gone home. Everyone except Kirsten and me. I remember it being my turn next, and the both of us running back to do one more stunt. The sun was starting to set, and we knew any minute our parents would call us. I remember running alongside her, sweating and gasping for breath as the laps tired our legs. Kirsten huffed and laughed as she ran, holding the bill of her ball cap so it wouldn't fly off. This one would be the craziest, I thought. It was my chance to really impress her. I would go into the woods this time, maybe even close to the highway. When we got to the driveway, however, we both stopped. Our smiles faded, and the fun seemed to fizzle away in an instant. There was an old, run-down trailer on the vacant lot, like it had appeared out of thin air. The dingy green paint was peeling, and the porch looked like it was about to collapse. The drapes and the windows were nicotine-stained and ratty, barely concealing the complete darkness within. As I watched, the front door creaked open slightly. From the darkness within, a groaning whisper escaped. No lights on inside. No car in the driveway.
What the?
I looked at Kirsten for validation, but she wasn't even looking at the trailer. She was looking at a woman in the yard. It was then that I noticed her, off towards the trees. She was standing with her back turned, and even though we couldn't see her face, we knew something was horribly wrong. Once white clothes were heavily stained and ripped up, fitting awkwardly on her frame. One of her legs was bent backwards, and one of her arms was missing, a heavy drizzle of blood oozing from the stump. Despite how mangled she was, she stood perfectly still. We just stood there for a time, both of us silently gawking at her. The air was chilly, like a temperature drop before a bad storm. Kirsten looked at me, the color drained from her face, and without a word, both of us looked in the direction of our homes to see which one was closest to run to. When we looked back in the direction of the woman, we noticed she had silently moved closer. Her back was still turned, but we could see the damage clearer. Horribly road-rashed muscle, black streaks on her clothing from the combination of tires and asphalt.
"What do we do?"
Kirsten whispered, her voice a whimper.
I don't know,"
I managed, my bladder suddenly feeling like it was going to burst. I remember my legs shaking.
"Maybe we could..."
Ahead of us, the woman turned. Not in a normal sense, but like she blinked to facing a different direction, like someone had flipped a paper over while our eyes were closed. The sight of her face provoked a gasp from both of us. I was crying now, filled with the confused fear you have when you wake up from a terrible nightmare. The woman was missing her bottom jaw, and with it, half of her upper face. The only identifiable thing left of her top jaw was a hanging, bloody tongue and her two front teeth. A single eye looked at me angrily, the pupil surrounded by the dark splotching of burst blood vessels. No sound emitted from the woman, but seeing the way she stood there, frozen in place, something was just wrong. Horribly wrong.
"Your house is closer. Run, get your mom,"
Kirsten whispered, her voice trembling. Her breath came out as fog. The mangled woman remained in place, but her single eye was looking at Kirsten now. Before our eyes, she blinked forward, 3 feet closer in Kirsten's direction. I wanted to reach for her hand, but it seemed so far away. I looked at her freckled face, tears streaming down them as she stood as still as possible. "But," I whimpered, and the mangled woman blinked again, a few more feet, facing my direction. Without a single sound, the eye glared angrily at me. I sobbed as she grew closer once more. Her eye dilated in response to my noise, and her only remaining hand twitched.
"Just go!"
Kirsten's shout echoed across the park, rustling birds from the trees. I turned and ran, my shoes skipping down the sidewalk. I couldn't breathe. I looked over my shoulder, and the terrified look on Kirsten's face as the woman shifted closer burned itself into my memory. Even as she drew closer still, Kirsten kept her eyes on me, weeping silently as she watched me go, as she made sure I could get away. My house was only a few trailers away, but I felt like I was running across town. My legs were weak, my thoughts racing. The further I got from that yard, the warmer it seemed to get. The sun began to feel hot, but my blood was still cold. I tried to focus on the patio door to my home, where my mom would be inside, where I could get her to save us. The adrenaline crawled across me like ice, and I thought, just for a moment, that everything was going to be okay. It was all just a nightmare. My mom would show up and fix things, just like she did all the other times I had a problem. But by the time I made it to my yard, Kirsten screamed. The shrill cry of terror and pain made me stumble, and I fell to the ground. I looked behind me frantically, but Kirsten and the woman were gone. All I could see was an empty yard, and I started shaking. I looked up to my front door, then back to where I left Kirsten. I didn't know what to do. I thought it would take too much time to get my mom. I shook and sobbed on the ground as my adolescent brain tried to compute the right thing to do. I just wanted to help. I just wanted her to be okay. In my fear, I wet myself. Behind me, Kirsten screamed again. She was getting further away. I got back on my feet and ran back to the phantom trailer, cursing myself for leaving her alone. We should have just run together. Why didn't we just run together? No, 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 I sobbed, my stomach desperately wanting to purge its contents. My legs begged me to stop, but I pushed them forward. My sneakers scuffed the sidewalk as the hot trail of urine ran down my leg. I ran past the neighbor's lot and rounded the corner of the trailer that shouldn't exist. When I got to the yard, I couldn't see either of them. The same awful chill returned, and a mist was working its way across the yard. My eyes followed the source, a ghostly fog that was cascading down the porch steps. It was spilling from the trailer, the tiny crack of the door, and the darkness inside. The doorway groaned as the fog billowed out, widening slightly with a creak. The windows started to bleed, and the shutters shriveled like burning plastic. But the worst thing of all was what I saw in the trees. The woman was dragging Kirsten by her arm, painfully whipping her around every time she blinked up the hill, dragging her towards the highway. I screamed for her to stop. The mangled woman paused, only for a moment, her destroyed mouth reverberating with what I could only describe as a snarl. Kirsten howled in pain as she clawed at the woman, the bruising grip worsening as her helpless hands passed through a seemingly ethereal body. Unnatural and horrible, the mangled woman ascended the hill, every freeze frame blink bringing them closer to the roaring traffic. I ran after them. I made it halfway across the yard before my foot caught something, sending me face first into the foggy ground. My palms slapped the ground, softening the fall on something rough and sharp. I tried to get up, but something grabbed my ankle, winding tight like a rope as I tried to shake it free. Kirsten's screaming got weaker the further she got from me. The fog dispersed as I thrashed to be free, and through it saw no grass at all. The canvas of pine needles and leaves was replaced by hundreds, thousands, of dead birds. I looked behind me and shouted for help, hoping to see my mom or one of the neighbors rushing to help. I saw nothing but an empty street and twisting vines wrapping around my ankles. When I turned back to the hill, Kirsten was holding onto a tree, trying to resist the mangled woman's grip. Her fingers clung to the bark, and her sneakers formed jagged ruts in the earth. This slowed the woman for a moment, but she retaliated by breaking Kirsten's wrist. The wet snap followed by the worst sound I have ever heard. I want to say I broke free. Sometimes when I dream, I break free from the vines, and I make it through the fog. Other times, grown-ups show up, and everything's okay. Sometimes Kirsten has the strength to free herself and we get away together. And sometimes there's no mangled woman at all. It's only a beaver. In reality, the true ending can never be denied. The version where my scream can only join hers. Scream as I reach helplessly, and the mangled woman makes it to the road. I watch as the truck takes them, an impact so forceful and sudden they simply blink away, leaving nothing but streaks on the highway and a hat on the wind that matched the color. The fog recedes into the trailer like a movie being rewound. The blood seeps back into the glass and the curtains unshrivel. The warmth returns and the parents flock outside, mortified as they press me for answers. In time, my screaming fades, replaced by the howling of sirens in the distance. I look up from the steering wheel and dry my tears. The parking lot's empty, and everyone else has left work except me. I think of the images in my head, the weeping eyes I can't unsee, cries I can't seem to forget. When I start my car and shift out of park, I think about the years that have passed by. I think of how I never really spoke to my friends again after that day, and how everyone seemed to chalk it up to two kids who were never supposed to play by the highway. The park seemed to fall apart after that, Kirsten's parents moving first, with my family to follow. I heard some sort of mass exodus followed that, a tiny little park reduced to nothing but a memory. Another traffic accident, another poor child lost. Tonight, instead of taking my usual route, I take a detour. I take the expressway until I see a road, one so ignored and unkempt you wouldn't know it was there if it wasn't for the reflecting green sign. A sign faded and almost illegible with age. A sign that reads, Rainbow Road. I turn onto the winding path, one that feels more like the entrance to a cemetery than a back road. My car rolls over broken pavement and traverses potholes until I see something in the distance, the only landmark in the otherwise empty place that has been consumed by weeds and overgrowth. As I approach the line of old rusted mailboxes, I slow down. Ahead is the concrete circle, but there are no homes, only a loop that's been slowly swallowed by the forest surrounding it. My headlights cut through the unnatural dark, the special kind that engulfs from the middle of nowhere. I think of a hot summer day and a bunch of bored kids with nothing to do. Letting my car idly crawl, I pull into the loop and survey my surroundings. On Rainbow Road, there are no mobile units to be seen. Each passing slab of the empty lot looks like a gravestone, a gritty reminder of young little lives that will be forever changed. I pass by Kirsten's old lot and think of her freckled face, the way she laughed, and the way she would roll her eyes when I made stupid jokes. I pass by the old lots of my friends' houses and wonder where they're at in the world. I pass by the lot where my home used to be and think of my mother, a time before the therapy I went through, a time before she started talking less and less. Driving past the old vacant lot, I see no mangled woman and no green trailer, only the lights of cars flying down the highway on the hill beyond. I look at this one longer, expecting to see something more, something of meaning. I look over the weathered surface of its foundation, years of rain slowly chipping away at the concrete, the grass that has overtaken the driveway, the thin layer of gravel reclaimed by the earth. I stare into the trees. I look at every wicked branch in the night. I search for those twisted limbs and malformed face and wonder if it's hiding somewhere in there. I listen for screams and find cicadas instead. Nothing but empty lots, overgrown grass, and fleeing rodents. When I reach the end of the circle, I see the exit and stop. I see the winding road and how it's been so long since I've been here. How I'll have no reason to come back. I let off the brake and keep turning left, going over the same vacant spaces again, but this time I think of the good times. I think of every dare that didn't end in tragedy. I think of every boring summer day where we climbed trees or played tag. I think of every smile Kirsten made and how it would give me butterflies in my stomach. When I reach the end of the circle, I decide to go again, my head filled with laughter and smiles, the kind no longer thought by a late 20s man. When that one's finished, it leads to another and another, each passing tree and remembered backyard spawning memories long buried under the suffering and loss long ago. Memories deserving remembrance. I kept on the loop for a while, holding the same angle on the wheel as I drove in a circle into the late hours of the night. I thought of many memories, reliving them like they were yesterday. Until something changed. The flashing strobe was blinding and unexpected, and part of me wondered how I didn't even see it coming in the first place. The squad car must have followed me with its lights off for a while, and I was none the wiser. I pulled my car over, right in front of where my old house used to be. Putting it in park, I sighed as he ran my plates. The cop took their time, both of our engines running idly in the middle of nowhere. When they finally emerged from their car, I had my license and registration ready. I rolled down the window in time to see an older officer, headlights illuminating a mustached face, white with age. When I offered my paperwork, he waved it off with a question.
"What are you doing out here this time of night, kid? Getting high? Getting drunk?"
he asked impatiently as he looked inside my car.
"No, just visiting a friend, I guess," I said, and he blinked at me. "Very funny. You know how many times I get called out here? Look, you kids come out here screwing around, shooting up, causing trouble where there's no reason for it. I thought maybe after they set fire to the last trailer out here and we leveled it with the dozer, that would be the end of it. But now you're here, driving circles until dispatch picks it up. There ain't nothing out here, kid. Either you're lying or you got the wrong address," he said sternly, his frown curving his mustache.
"She passed away a long time ago. She was hit by a truck, on the highway," I said, and there was an immediate sadness in his eyes.
"I'm sorry to hear that," he said, and collected himself. "That was a long time ago, but I remember it clearly. I was first on the scene. Terrible, terrible thing. The family brought flowers out here for years, and after everyone moved away, they were the last people who came by that weren't trying to cause trouble. But after a while, they stopped coming. Now, this place is just an overgrown hole," he said solemnly, trailing off.
I thought of the family visiting each year, and the thought of long wilted flowers deeply saddened me. I looked around the park as the officer collected himself, looking over the empty lots until my eyes rested on the particular one two doors down from mine. I felt the icy chill crawl over me again, but the officer's voice pulled me away.
"You're that boy. I never thought I'd see you again, let alone recognize you."
"Yeah, I haven't been here since it happened. Felt like I had to stop by," I said, peering through the lights at him.
"Well, I'm sorry I gave you such a rough time. And I'm sorry about your friend. People like to come out here and cause trouble. The park was never the same after that, and once everyone moved out, it was a hot spot for squatters and the like for a while. It's private property, and the owner calls and raises hell every time he sees people out here. I understand you're paying respects, but I'm gonna have to ask you to leave. I'll follow you out," he said, and started to leave himself.
Without much to say, I just nodded and rolled up my window. The officer continued walking away, and I watched his silhouette shrink in the side mirror as he made his way to his car. When he reached the door, he stopped, his hand pausing as he reached for the handle. After a moment, he turned around and started walking back. I waited for the mustached face to come into view and rolled the window down again.
"Hey, kid," he asked, his brow furrowing a little.
"Yeah," I said. The air was feeling chillier, a light fog rolling over the road. The sight of it made me sick to my stomach.
"Back then, when the accident happened and I arrived on the scene, you kept saying the same thing over and over. Green trailer, lady in the woods," he said, leaning on the door.
"I remember," I say, but I'm not looking at him anymore. My eyes are held ahead.
"Are you sure that's what you saw? Are you sure that's what happened?"
he asked, and I could feel him studying my face. "I'm positive, no doubt in my mind.
Why? I ask, looking to the side of the road, to the darkness beyond the headlights.
When we arrived, there was no trailer. There wasn't any woman in the woods either. Asked every resident in the park. Nobody saw anything. We searched for miles, thinking maybe you were right and someone had fled the scene. Even got a helicopter.
Did you find anyone? I said, gripping the steering wheel.
Nobody.
Ah. In the dark, I traced the faint outline of something ahead, rectangular.
But here's the thing. After talking to all the neighbors, we spoke to the landlord. When we mentioned what you said you saw, he turned white, almost fainted. Said it was impossible. Said he had been running the park for over 20 years, and in all that time, there'd only been one green trailer, in the 80s, he said, and paused to chew his lip.
A young couple used to live there. Pretty young woman, with a drunk for a husband. Whenever he wasn't sunk in a bottle, he was getting into drugs. Always late with rent. Always yelling and screaming at each other. The landlord said sometimes when they fought, he would beat her up pretty bad. She would walk around the loop, waiting for her husband to calm down or fall asleep. Said she would ask for help from the neighbors, knocking on doors as she went. They helped, at first, but it happened a lot, they said. And she would always go back home. They would make up and things would quiet down for a while, but it would always get bad again. Back then, it was a different time. Police didn't do much to help her, I'm afraid. After a while, they stopped taking her calls. Not long after that, the neighbors stopped helping altogether. It was just a thing that happened.
The fog started to get thicker, but the officer didn't seem to notice.
One night, after an especially bad fight, he beat her up real bad and left. Took the car and just left her there. Landlord said she came out eventually, limping, her face all swollen, mumbling his name as she walked the loop in the middle of the night, waiting for him to come back, I guess. But he never did. And she kept walking, even after everyone put their lights out for the night. When morning came, she was gone.
Through the fog, I could see the outline of windows in the rectangular shape and the dark structure of a porch.
Police found her on the highway. Hit and run. Nobody knows if it was grief taking hold or if she was just trying to catch a ride into town. Afterward, they pulled the trailer from that lot and never put another one on it. Never allowed another green one either.
I thought of Kirsten's scream and the floating ball cap.
Look, kid, I don't know what you saw that day, but I'm sorry about the whole thing, and I'm sorry you lost your friend,
the officer said and patted his hand on the hood awkwardly.
Do you see it now? I asked, pointing forward.
The officer raised his eyebrows and looked into the distance. I watched as his face softened with worry and his eyes narrowed on what lay ahead. Without a word, he grabbed his flashlight and aimed it in the yard. With a faint click, the beam cut through the dark, and he panned it slowly around the property.
I watched it shine over the fog, and shine on a familiar, dingy green paint,
ratty, stained drapes, and a mangled figure at the end of the yard.
I don't see anything, kid, he said, and shut off his flashlight.
I just looked into the darkness, transfixed by what I knew was still standing there.
Me neither. Sorry for causing trouble. You have a good night, officer, I said, and started rolling up my window.
He looked like he wanted to stop me, but in the end, he let me go. I drove past the empty lots and rusty mailboxes, keeping my eyes forward till I was through the winding road that led out of the park. I didn't realize I was holding my breath until I was turning back onto the main roads. Once I was out, the icy feeling withered away, and I was welcomed by the comfort of green traffic lights. As I left the park behind me, I released my grip on the wheel and felt the tension in my shoulders melt away. I sighed exhaustedly, keeping my foot on the gas until I made it to the clover leaf that led me here. I took the ramp quickly, knowing the highway would overlook the park and ultimately take me home. I don't know why I took that way, whether it was just me being defiant, or maybe I just felt like I had to. Or maybe
inside the safety of my car, I thought I would be all right. Merging onto the highway, I sped onto the overlook and could see the empty park and its wooded sanctuary. Below, I could see the slow-moving headlights of the officer leaving. The fog and trailer were gone, and with it, the mangled woman. I returned my eyes to the road just in time to see a hitchhiker walking on the shoulder. They walked slowly, leisurely kicking rocks as they went. As I approached, they stopped and looked at me, slowly waving as I rapidly approached. It was a little girl, with a freckled face and a red ball cap. When I checked the rearview mirror, she was gone. You've just heard Rainbow Road by Jesse Pollins. Jesse Pollins is an American short fiction writer and Hawaiian shirt enthusiast from the Midwest. With a love for horror and suspense, he draws heavy inspiration from retro video games and classic creepypastas. I'll admit, folks, with Jesse being a retro game enthusiast, Rainbow Road had far fewer banana peels and Koopa shells than I expected. Oh well, I guess I won't be reliving my Mario Kart days after all. Regardless, I hope that you enjoyed tonight's entertainment. I hope to see more of Jesse's work on the show in the future. And in the meantime, I'll encourage you to head to velixbooks.com to check out more of his work. That should tide you over until next week, when I'll be back with more stories to keep you shivering through the winter. Until then, listeners, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.